not far, you're not close enough. Sorry, young boy. I'm gonna have to knock this down.
I feel good, man. I've been in my bag all year.
Clemens reverses it, and the pass goes into the end zone.
To Nick Foles.
And it's a touchdown by Nick Foles.
Yellow Ford for the final time. Number 24 on the floor. Five world champion, Kobe Bryant.
What's going on, listeners? It's Alex here from the In My Bag podcast. Back again for another edition of the show. I'm joined as always by Kenny. Kenny, what's going on?
What up?
You good? How are you? This is a we'll do a quarantine health check real quick.
Healthy as I know I myself to be without insurance right now. So.
Okay. Well, you continue to say healthy.
Symptomless.
You are symptomless or not symptomless?
I am symptomless.
Okay, that's good. You said not and then symptomless, and I was like, should we be talking about something a little bit more serious then?
No.
Yeah, I'm also good. Thanks for asking. Us essential workers are, you know, we're hanging in there. I've been drinking a ton of body armor. I actually have one right here that I'm about to crack open.
And say, meanwhile, I have just been drinking.
Well, you know, you put rubbing alcohol on cuts to clean them, help them, you know, heal. Why not alcohol on your insides?
Right. I figure it's doing some type of, you know, antibacterial disinfecting. Gotta be.
Okay. I guess we should go on record and saying neither of us are doctors, nor are we recommending any kind of medical treatments to solve any ailments. So let's go ahead and go on record right there to make sure that we stay not only healthy, but also keep our bag secured.
Always secure the bag. Always.
Always. All right. So today on the podcast, we're going to be talking about the NFL draft and the Last Dance documentary that dropped last week. The first two episodes dropped last week. We're going to share our thoughts about the doc. We're going to share our thoughts about the first round of the NFL draft. But first, Kenny, you have any underrated, overrated? We didn't talk about this before the pod, but I'm just going to impromptu ask you about it.
Underrated is living an active lifestyle, even if it's not necessarily getting up and working every day. There is a major difference between getting up, moving, and being active throughout the day and not. And I can assure you, getting up and moving is the one that has a much, much better effect on you. And I'll think about overrated while you give it underrated.
Sure, yeah, I want to piggyback on that. Underrated is definitely being active mentally and physically so that you are not, you know, kind of stewing in this uncertain time. But I guess my underrated, I guess, is body armor. I've been drinking a ton of it lately. I have an Amazon subscription now. I am partaking in the fruit punch for now until I get tired of it.
Are you buying the single drink flavor cases, or are you getting the varieties and just going through a flavor at a time?
Single flavor cases.
Bro, get that variety pack.
Maybe, but I'm good for now. The fruit punch is definitely serving me well. If anybody's unfamiliar, Body Armor is kind of like Gatorade, but better. Less sugar. Feels like more flavor to me, and
it actually has vitamins
better.
And nutrients.
Yes, vitamins and nutrients and electrolytes, whereas Gatorade just has salt and sugar. So definitely try it out. If anyone was unaware, that was a early investment by Kobe Bryant that I had tried back when it first was starting to get popular. But that was before my taste buds were adjusted to coconut water. So it did not play out well for me the first time around, but now it's good to me. I actually feel hydrated when I drink it. Like after I drink it, I can kind of feel like an uptick in hydration, shortly after.
See, it makes me feel really hipstery because it's one of those things where I was in on it before finding out about it being, Kobe having a stake in it or it being a sponsor for UFC. So it's always one of those good, oh yeah, I knew about that before it was popular moments that I get to have.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always nice to be on the first wave of things.
Big time.
Big time. All right, you got overrated?
Yes, overrated. Overrated is delivery. Clutch as delivery can and may be. It is oftentimes overrated because more times than not, like, you're paying for delivery, you pay about $5 extra between delivery fees, service fees, taxes, and automated tip. And it takes longer for you to get it via delivery than if you actually got up and got in your car and just went to the drive-thru or ordered takeout. And it costs less to go and get it yourself.
Mm-hmm. I totally, totally agree. I run into that. I used to run into that problem a lot with, you know, being around people. They're like, oh, let's just order something. I'm like, why don't we just go get it? Like, why are we going to wait an hour and pay more money when we could just drive 6 to 8 minutes down the road and get it in 6 to 8 minutes?
Right. And mind you, on top of that, you pay more, you wait longer to get it, and it's not nearly as fresh as, again, if you were to go and get it yourself and, like, literally be there when it's ready to take it home, as opposed to somebody gets a ping saying that the order's ready, then they go pick it up and bring it to you. It's like, just go get it, bro. Sometimes delivery is worth it. More times than not, carry out is better.
Now, to be clear, we haven't factored in the whole safer at home aspect of it all.
Right, that don't count right now.
I don't necessarily know how that plays into ordering, because I still, even though you're supposed to be in your home for as much as possible, I still find myself wanting to go and get my food if I'm not, you know, well, I don't cook.
But you know what?
If there's not food at home.
Here's my take on that. Even with that, most places that are still, actually everywhere that is still open currently has a curbside takeout, most of which often exceed attempts to be as non-contact as possible. I've seen stuff as far as a table set up in the doorway where the person comes up, sets the food on the table when you're ready to pick it up, and you pick it up and go. I've seen sit food on the drive-thru windowsill. You grab it yourself, they close the window after you pull off. Like, bro, just get in the car and go. Just stay home. Yeah, cool. But if you're literally not getting out of your car to interact with anybody, it's pretty much the same as staying home. It's like staying home, homeless edition.
That's problematic. but your point stands. Okay.
So
that was a good overrated.
Stop being lazy, save some money while you ain't got no job, and get carry out, busters.
I guess my overrated right now would be furniture, I guess. Right now my sisters are staying with me during the quarantine times, brought their children so that, you know, takes a village, all that whatnot. And they are slowly trying to put furniture in my home that I feel is unnecessary, like a $3,000 sectional was just purchased, and I'm like,
bruh, sectionals are the business, couches. Though. I'm not gonna lie, like, sectionals are the business.
No. I'm not debating the function of the sectional. The price is outrageous. Secondly, the couches need to be replaced. Cool. Now, my thing today is, There was perusing of Wayfair for a table that would just be sat in the foyer, like, essentially no real purpose but to catch junk, and you're gonna spend $200 on a table? Get out of here. No, I'm vetoing that. No, it's not happening. We're not paying $200 for a table that doesn't have a specific purpose.
I was going to say, yeah, I'm not going to lie. Like $200 just to catch keys and maybe a wallet on the way through the door. Like, just go to IKEA at that point.
No, don't buy anything. It's not necessary. Like, for it's not like it's not needed. Don't spend the money.
But they can't help it, that's Alex. The stimulus check just hit, bruh. They got a rack to burn through, and it's got to go somewhere.
You know they're talking about more payments.
That is fine by me.
You know, I don't know. I don't know how I feel exactly, but I definitely feel like people should be taken care of. So,
like, I'm pro stimulus, but definitely anti open up the whole country. Like, just make more stuff readily available through online ordering, and we can keep the economy at bay that way.
Yeah, I mean, I just ordered some stuff online today. Actually, I ordered on Amazon when I woke up this morning, and then I just ordered like some shirts and stuff before we started recording. So it's the economy's a touchy subject because it's never. I mean, nothing's going to be the same, regardless of what kind of stimulus packages are put into place. But we have to be careful about, you know, people's health and also people's financial health as well, and also physical health.
Man, like my man Marshawn Lynch said, make sure you take care of your chickens and take care of your mentals. If only knew you need to take care of your physicals too, because he ain't noticed Corona was around the corner.
I bet he knew. I think he knew. He just didn't tell anybody. He's that kind of petty.
I bet he sent like 5,000 pounds of vitamins, nutrients, and flu medication to Beto.
Oh, really?
No, I'm just making that up.
Oh, that's speculation. Oh, okay. I was like, I mean, that sounds like something he would do,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. I'm sure he did. We just don't know about it.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back in with the NFL draft and discuss the first round that went down last night. We'll be back. And we're back. Thanks again for tuning in to the In My Bag podcast. We are going to talk about the NFL draft that happened last night. Now, I wasn't able to watch it live, but Kenny, you were, correct?
Yes, I watched it live from beginning to end, as a matter of fact.
Okay, so tell me the vibe. What was it like watching a virtual draft for real people?
It's a little weird. My first take was it's very weird to hear people using their on-screen professional voices but see them inside their homes. Parts of it almost felt a little overproduced. I like that they had instead of a laugh track, they had a boo track for Roger Goodell. So I kind of liked him being able to poke a little fun at himself. I'm always, you know, pro people being able to take a good joke in stride. Production on it ran pretty well. I guess it was just, there was always that small level of awkwardness of, you know, they're not walking across the stage happily greeting the commissioner, shedding tears. They're, for the most part, mildly unreactive in their living rooms with anywhere from 2 to 5 people. And it was weird. You know, it was like everybody that got drafted was like that player that didn't get the invite to the draft or wasn't able to make it out to the draft and had to get cut in on their living room, kind of not quite on time celebrating or getting the call that they're being drafted.
Yeah, I would imagine that was a weird thing to see. I would have liked to see it, especially for the first round. Now, second, third on, I don't even think I'm going to watch it anyway, because that's the kind of vibe that usually happens anyway. Like, there's a lot of cutting in, basically just people watching whoever's announcing the pick from, like, the, you know, the arena that they hosted at. So it's not many players getting on stage anymore.
I'd love to see if there's any truth to it. Another thing I made observation of was that at least for maybe like the first 15 to 20 or so picks, it ran through incredibly quickly. It seemed like I said, that first half of the draft or so, first 15 to 20, it was just like, boom, pick is in. 2 to 3 minutes, boom, your pick is in. 2 to 3 minutes, boom, your pick is in. All right, we got to cut to commercial for the sake of making this broadcast programming last as long as it's scheduled to. And it almost felt like there were times where it almost seemed like they would have them continue their conversation or their narration about a particular player and their skill sets and maybe some outlook after the draft and speculation moving forward, in spite of picks being in, just for the sake of kind of filling up that time that they had to have.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think they do that in real life and when it was in person as well. I think they waited, 90 to 120 seconds after a pick was actually in. And you also saw it, like, on the ticker, you see, like, pick is in, and they're still talking. Mm-hmm. And then finally it's like, oh, let's cut to the commissioner for the pick.
Yeah, and I think part of it is also instead of having to cut to different studios and different broadcasting tables and analyst tables, instead you could just basically swap out in a transition who you had in your picture-in-picture in terms of who was on screen. So maybe that cut down on some time. Maybe knowing it wasn't going to be live and on the spot, it was probably at least a little bit more rehearsed in terms of, not to say that it didn't rehearsed in the first go around, stuff like that. You have to, you know, have it down to a T and be as ready as you can be with something that's going to be live and unpredicted or mildly predictable. But I think you had to even more so have it down to a T and ready to go and be curtain ready with their production, with everybody doing this from home and having to even more so be on the same page to make it run smoothly. And it almost ran too smoothly, you could say. Because like I said, that first half, picks were flying.
I mean, we can also say that maybe teams knew what they wanted. I mean, there were no trades at the top, so teams were kind of ready with their first and second choices. And since things kind of played out fairly predictably at the top, I think it makes teams ready to, you know, submit their pick and move on.
Yeah, I definitely agree. A lot of this draft kind of, for the most part, it went according to schedule, especially, like you said, through that first half of the draft. Maybe a little bit of motion in between where players are projected to go, where they actually went. But for the most part, you could look at a top-level mock draft for the last 2 or 3 weeks, and it's about lined up in queue with who's going where.
Let's talk about the picks. I know you want to talk about Burrow going first. You have any thoughts on that?
I mean, not really, because like I said, most of those, especially at the top, a lot of the picks that went to places where we knew they were going to go because it's either a best player available or the best player is also a need for the team type situation. It actually makes me want to ask you, are you of the mindset, because we've seen this a lot, particularly in the last 3 drafts, where the best player on the board is not always the best player taken. So are you of a mindset where you feel like best quarterback available is a better choice than the best player available more times than not?
Well, I mean, I think you should know the answer to that. I don't think just wedging a quarterback into a spot because he's the best is the best option. I think you should take what you need and not what's flashy or what fans might think they need. I mean, the Bengals needed a quarterback. I don't necessarily, Burrow probably wouldn't have been my guy because I'm not wowed by him. But I don't think I think he can still be productive for the Bengals. So that's a fine pick. Personally, I probably would have traded down with like Miami and got a little bit more value and still came out with a good quarterback.
Definitely.
But I mean, I don't think they made a poor choice.
To be completely frank, I would almost have, and I think I've made my point on this pretty well known, I'm always in the standpoint of if you are the top draft pick and the player that's available is not, and you know, as much as I love LSU, the success this season and the huge role that Joe Burrow played in it, I wouldn't call him a generational, transcendent level talent. You know, he's great. He's arguably the best, or if not second best, quarterback available this year in terms of production, talent, and NFL readiness. But the Bengals are far from a quarterback away from making a splash,
making noise,
and making some noise in the NFL. The Ravens are on the come up. The Steelers and the Browns are at a bit of an impasse wherein they have to make a decision over the course of the next year or two about who they're going to be and what direction they're going to be going in. I think they're going to be going in opposite directions. And that leaves the Bengals with realistically about a 2, maybe even 3 year window where you have to be more intelligent about what you want to do with those draft picks. And I'm sure they could have gotten a heck of a haul for that number one draft pick from teams that are closer to being a quarterback away from being able to win in terms of getting back maybe player talent and picks as well. Maybe just being able to accumulate multiple picks and be able to really build and create an entire team, because that's what you need to be successful.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I just hate to see situations like this, because the pick almost always feels squandered, because it's usually a great player going to a bad team and a bad organization and not really having an honest chance to be great. Like I said, the lone exception that I've seen anytime recently is maybe Andrew Luck, and that was because he was coming into a situation where the team wasn't bad. You just had an all-world quarterback get injured and miss an entire season, which is going to sink just about any team except for maybe prime New England Patriots.
Now, yeah, I totally agree with that, because famously, the quarterback is the last piece you want to add to your puzzle, because you want to hold down his salary until he actually, I mean, and you know, get to a championship with your quarterback on a bargain. I mean, I haven't done the research, but how many of the last 10 Super Bowl winners, I mean, not counting the Patriots, I mean, not even counting the Patriots, like who, the quarterback can't be your highest paid player and you make a Super Bowl. That usually doesn't happen. So for Burrow, for them to go ahead and get Burrow now, you're going to burn probably half of his very reasonable contract trying to build towards something great. So it might have served you better just to trade down and try to piece it together that way. But we'll see what happens with Burrow. I think he's a fine quarterback. I think he can do some things in this league. So we'll see. What are some other picks that either surprised you or got you interested in seeing how that's going to turn out after seeing how everything played out in the first round?
I think one of the bigger ones, because like I said, very little of what happened towards the top surprised me. Most of it was more disappointments and bad picks for the most part through the back end of the draft. One of the later picks that came about that I really liked and really want to see how it develops and comes along is definitely going to be the Baltimore Ravens taking Patrick Queen out of LSU, somebody that I watched a lot of in college coming through that program. And I think with the way they played football, sideline to sideline, his ability from honestly multiple linebacker positions to be able to have the IQ, the vision, and the focus to recognize plays, react quickly, and move from sideline to sideline to make plays both in the passing game and running game, he's going to be a huge asset. I think being able to be in contact with guys like Ray Lewis and other great defensive players that have come through that organization and are always hanging around and all about getting back to it and mental. Point blank, I just would love to see the matching of Patrick Queen with a Ray Lewis mentorship to really shore up his minor weakness in the running game, which is he's not a big linebacker, so he's not going to easily shed a lot of blocks in some power run schemes. Well, like I said, he's about to be in a pro NFL program that's going to put some meat on those bones. He's going to be getting them good first-round draft pick paychecks so he can afford the good food. He ain't got to just, you know, go all you can eat at the school buffet no more. So that's going to be a huge one to see. And keeping to the theme of watching out for my LSU guys, Justin Jefferson, the two offensive ends of that, Justin Jefferson going to Minnesota, and I think he's essentially going to split wide out and slot time with Adam Thielen and kind of be the new combo that they had with Adam Thielen and Stephon Diggs. I think that's huge for him because he thrives with another wide receiver talent to be able to get him into more one-on-one matchups. And I think the biggest one we'll see next year is going to be the last pick from the first round. And I think that...
Oh, the right word, running back?
Yeah. Edwards-Helaire is going to be great in that offense because a lot of what they did last year and a lot of what they'll look to do next year is going to look a lot like what we saw Brady doing in New Orleans, which is spread the ball out, get guys one-on-one, make the defense show you what it wants to do, and get guys the ball in open field. And he can catch, he can run, he can be the last option on offense or the first option. He's a very unselfish running back in that sense. And not to mention, they don't have a lot of cap space. So to be able to acquire a player of that talent in the backfield when you really don't have any type of star running back presence at the moment.
Yeah, I definitely thought that was a good pick. It didn't make my list of notables, but I think it's definitely noteworthy. To go off of your first point, the Ravens did make a great pick with that linebacker. Their offense is already fine-tuned machine. So I think this draft is going to be spent a lot on defense so that Lamar has help on the other side. I'm just going to run through some of the picks that I thought was great. Obviously, Washington taking Young was a solid pick.
Of course.
I mean, they already had a solid... Yeah, they had a solid front seven, but, I mean, Young, you can't pass on Young. This kind of reminds me of when, like, the Eagles took Derek Barnett with their first-round pick a few years ago. It was like they already had a good pass rush, but they're like, ah, let's just throw some more fuel on that fire.
Mm-hmm.
I like Tua going to Miami. I was kind of hoping that the Dolphins would have taken Cam Newton. I would have loved to see his outfits down there.
I mean, like, but,
I mean, there's still
right. You, I feel like you're about to say it right now, but like, there's still the possibility that if you're really a smart organization, which Miami has not shown itself to be for a long time, rest Tua for a year, bring in Cam, put him on a 1 year contract, let him show he can do what he really wants to do and is capable of doing, and get a bigger contract somewhere else. Do that, Kirk Cousins, bet on yourself. You know, let's see what we got.
This is exactly what I was going to say, especially with Tua's health being a red flag. To the Chargers, taking Herbert, thought was excellent. He's one of my favorite QBs in the draft. And I think the Chargers already have a solid array of weapons that will only help him develop. I'm a little confused about Jacksonville taking a cornerback in the first round. It wasn't an awful pick, but I thought they should have went QB or wide out. That was a little strange. Baker got a little bit more help. What he really needed, a tackle. So that's good for the Browns. The Raiders made a strong choice in Ruggs. I don't know who's going to be throwing to him in the next 2 or 3 years, but I mean, it doesn't really matter. He's going to go get the ball.
Receive it.
And then we come to the Bucks. Sorry, go ahead.
The only thing that makes me wary on Ruggs isn't him himself. It's just that Oakland John Madden curse of draft the fastest player in the draft this year and then watch him not do anything for us but possibly go on to some other team and be much better and accomplish much more in his role. So I don't
think that's on Gruden though.
But I think Oakland taking that pick is bad. Because I personally just think it's a bad idea to draft a wide receiver. Right. Sorry. For the Raiders to take that pick. Because I always think it's a bad idea to draft a wide receiver if you don't have a quarterback. And there's just something in the back of my head telling me that Carr is not that quarterback. And I hate to see a waste of Ruggs' talent in Oakland, Las Vegas, or wherever.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I mean, I don't know who the quarterback's going to be, but I think Gruden can scheme Ruggs into his offense and, you know, be productive. Now, what I was going to go say was about the Bucks. They're having an amazing week.
Oh, my gosh.
Amazing 2 weeks. Yeah, like the best thing you can do for Tom Brady for his age and his pedigree is to get him someone who can protect him, and they definitely did that.
And then to get him one of the most
Cowboys
athletic linemen that probably I feel like it's pretty common mindset that the top, like, four offensive tackles that were in the draft this year were, I don't want to say the same because there's usually a bit of order in which people have them, but you can't really miss on either of the four of them. It's just about what type of lineman you're looking for the most part, or what fits your offense the best. And I feel like in terms of somebody who's going to be able to grow with that offense and has the raw talent and ability to plug in right now and be a great right tackle, I think they got the best one, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Now, the Cowboys taking CeeDee.
Oh,
God, that's dangerous.
That hurt.
Yeah, it did. I was hoping that the Eagles would snatch him up. And I'm not sure how I feel about Dak's abilities at this point, but now he has a slew of talent. So it's officially put up or shut up territory. Cause he has everything he needs now,
except the contract.
He's got an offensive line. He has a running back. He has wide receivers. Yeah. And a contract besides a contract, but I mean, go play and earn your contract.
What has he been doing?
But yeah,
that's a whole conversation.
I mean, he's been playing fine. Yeah, Eagles taking Rager is fine with me. Personally, I probably would have picked Sims or Ayuk, because I feel like we need a home run threat. Because I don't think Deshaun is gonna be that for us.
or even Jefferson. Like,
and then
any other wide receiver.
Yeah. Yeah, Jefferson too.
Like, I hate to put this weight on Reagan out the gate, but like, I just hope that there's something in the tape, something in the scheme that they have planned that we don't know about, because at the very least, from the eye test and the paper test and the stat test, there were better options available. And for some reason, Philly chooses to take the undersized speed guy who has not proven himself as a number one real go-get-it kind of guy. He's just been a gadget guy, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There were the choices at wide receiver at that point were still plentiful. But I'm just going to trust the system, and hopefully Rager fits in and does what we need him to do.
Hopes.
And the last notable pick I have on my list is the Packers going up and getting a QB in the first round. It seems like they were trying to reuse their model that yielded Rodgers to the team while Favre was still doing his thing. But I watched Jordan Love a lot over the years, and I think he's going to be a solid QB, and it helps a lot that he doesn't have the pressure of being a day one starter on his shoulders. So I think it's a solid pick. It's just very confusing for the Packers at this point.
Right. I was just about to say, I feel like it's a good pick for anybody that's not the Packers. I like Jordan Love. I like Jordan Love in a scenario where he gets to sit behind a great passer, learn, gets time to really gel and vibe with his offensive coordinator, his head coach, learn the scheme, learn the system, get in a professional weight room and a professional dietary plan, and really, you know, get to learn how to become a pro before having to take over the organization or the offense. But Green Bay had way too many other needs besides wanting their future quarterback, especially in a guy in Jordan Love, where he could be a really good NFL player in the future. But it's kind of in that same boat of teams at the number one picking a quarterback to try to save their future, set their future. And there's other stuff you need. There's always going to be at least 2 to 3 good quarterbacks coming out of college. Take the best talent available there. Like, get Aaron Rodgers a wide receiver, a tight end, some defensive help, because the defense was doing good last year. Improve on the defense and give Aaron Rodgers more room for error if you're not going to acquire an offensive asset. But, man, it feels like, and I hate to, you know, echo so many different headlines this morning, but it almost feels like they're putting Aaron Rodgers on the clock, and I don't like that direction. I feel like it was great. It worked with Brett Favre, and it drew some success, but, you know, don't try to make lightning strike twice. You won't always survive.
That's true. That's a great point. I totally agree with that. Any last thoughts about the first round?
I had a similar level of disappointment with the 49ers taking who did they take? The defensive tackle at South Carolina, Kinlaw. I feel like, you know, that's another situation wherein I can understand that part of it was, you know, making salaries work to a degree, being able to have financial security, unlike what Kansas City is going through and trying to avoid running into those same issues. But I feel like more than another defensive lineman, they could have used an offensive weapon to really help Jimmy Garoppolo along.
Yeah, there are so many offensive players on the board at 14. Literally all the wide receivers besides Ruggs. Almost all of the offensive linemen that were eligible. Yeah, it was a weird pick, but they're okay. And then they also went ahead and got a wide receiver at the end. So yeah, I think it's okay.
I'll say aside from that, I can't think of too many other just like great picks or major picks that really stood out to me.
Okay.
I think everybody else kind of
we can wrap it there.
Picked in their wheelhouse and stuff that fit good picks, yeah. But nothing just like spectacular, mind blowing, like. Oh my gosh, we just gotta hit on this real quick.
Mm-hmm. We'll have a chance to wrap on the entire draft next week once the other rounds are done. But we're going to go ahead and close the book on round one and also take a break. And we're going to come back and talk about The Last Dance. So stay tuned for that. All right, we're back. And ready to talk about the Last Dance documentary on ESPN, Kenny. Initial thoughts?
My first thought after watching the first two episodes was definitely, it was definitely a lot of thoughts focused on not being aware of the seemingly toxic relationship between Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, and Jerry Krause, and it honestly being about two completely separate altercations that each of them had. And it's funny that Michael Jordan was full in on how he felt about it based on his experience with Krause. But once the shoe was on the other foot and something happened with Scottie Pippen and Jerry Krause and they had their misunderstanding that made Pippen feel a particular type of way, he wasn't feeling any of what Pippen was putting down about it, if you get what I mean. Like,
yeah, I understand. Yeah, he felt Scottie played it wrong. And I can share my thoughts about that later. Keep going.
So yeah, that was definitely a big one. Second one was that just kind of something that I've been noticing, you know, happening a lot. It kind of happened with us when we did our soon to be broadcast airing, wherein we kind of watched and just commentated on and analyzed a classic NBA game, wherein there's just a lot of, I guess, background to a lot of stuff that happened in 90s sports, especially early and mid-90s, that we just didn't really have the background information on because we weren't super huge into sports news. You know, maybe the sport itself, maybe the players themselves, but not the news behind it like we're behind news behind it nowadays where everything that breaks is on the phone, in the news, on the internet somewhere, whereas back then, if you weren't reading newspapers, reading sports articles, had an inside line to, you know, Chicago papers, you probably weren't that aware of the relationship between Jerry Krause and Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, or that it had already been pre-declared this would be the last run for that Bulls dynasty, and just just a lack of awareness of what was really going on in the NBA at that time versus what it seemed like was happening or what the story is of what was happening.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I definitely, I mean, we were five when this was all going on. So it was hard. It was impossible for us to really understand the nuance. I was six as well then, Jesus. It was impossible for us to understand the nuance of what was going on, solely based on our age. Now, this documentary is good. It's definitely a lot of great information, stuff that I never knew, and some great insights on the people who were actually there. But there's this thing about documentaries that's been a heavy theme lately, is where it's being produced to portray an angle instead of portraying facts.
Mm-hmm.
And the angle on this documentary is definitely anti-Kraus, but neutral on Reisendorf, which is weird because Kraus didn't really do anything without Reisendorf's approval. So it was very unfair to portray him in that way, especially since he's no longer with us. But I feel like that was a heavy-handed tactic by MJ.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I don't expect anything less from him. He's a petty king.
Oh, super.
Yeah. So that was my first takeaway from watching both in its entirety twice. I definitely feel like they're definitely taking an angle on Kraus to make him out to be the bad guy, when I have some points later on that might definitely shift the focus of who was really trying to tear it down. Another point I wanted to make off the rip was the music was excellent in that doc.
Big time.
It definitely kept you engaged. Biggest question right now, Kenny, is would you take Christmas presents or a ticket to see MJ in the regular season?
Like, I can either have Christmas presents or tickets to see MJ?
Yes, you have to pick one.
So I can't, but what if tickets to see MJ are in the presents?
No.
So it's definite the tickets to see MJ are not in the Christmas presents.
Correct.
I would take tickets to see MJ. Like, Christmas is going to come around. Christmas is going to come around again next year. Like, all right, so I'll put it like this. With me as I am nowadays, and just the general accessibility of the NBA or sports in general nowadays, I can understand that it's a lot harder to really be able to appreciate the limited opportunity to go and see somebody of that magnitude play. But every opportunity, like, an opportunity like that, I almost can't pass up, because I can appreciate the likelihood of not getting to do that ever again. It's almost all like, right, when LeBron was in Cleveland, anytime he would come to Memphis around February, near February, in the general vicinity, Cleveland was playing Memphis, I was like, look, you got to email. Don't worry about the birthday, none of that. Just give me tickets to the game. We good to go. See, I only get this once a year. If that's if I'm available on the day it's going to happen. That's if it's financially feasible to happen for me in the first place. And that's if the game is even here in the first place.
I mean, it has to be there. They have to come at least once. But, all right, so here's my counterpoint to those children. At that age, so the thing about memory is that it's very unreliable.
Mm-hmm.
And now, to have the memory of seeing Michael Jordan at the peak of his powers, it live in person, is great. But here are my devil's advocate points to that. One, they're probably not going to be close to, like, see the sweat dripping off that man. Those are seats worth taking, because that's a different experience than being mid or very high up. Two, Now you get to see the game. Awesome. You have that memory for about 36 months, and then your brain starts to change the memory to a point where did you really even see it anyway? Like, you know you were there, but what can you reliably remember about it?
I mean, what if you get some good pictures, though?
In 1997?
Yeah, you get there early.
What's a good picture?
Like, you get there early, stand in front of, like, the courtside entrance and take pictures while the Bulls are warming up. Maybe you can get a picture or two while some action is actually going on.
Yeah, maybe. Whatever.
And that's something you can cherish for your entire life. You only do that one time. That game system, that's going to be there next year. Those video games are going to be there next year. That basketball is going to be there next year.
Here's my counterpoint to that. You got to think about long-term investments. The video games, the basketballs, they're going to last a lot longer than that experience that you got to see Michael Jordan. Technically, as far as you're spending 2 hours with Michael Jordan versus spending, you know, however long your presence lasts you.
Right, but I guess my point on it is if it's so crucial of a decision that I have to choose between go see Michael Jordan or get Christmas presents, that means that seeing Michael Jordan probably isn't going to come around again anytime soon. Christmas is definitely coming back around again next year. I mean, unless I die, in which case I don't give a rat's ass about Christmas.
Yeah, I mean, there's no wrong answer to this. I was just trying to play both sides on it.
Yeah, I could definitely see the other side. Me personally, like, if it's at the point where I have to pick between this and all my Christmas presents, clearly this is a very limited time offer that's going on right here. This is buy one t-shirt, get 5 t-shirts for free in the Nike store. You know, I can do this now or I can save my money, but this probably won't come around again anytime soon, if ever again.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting to see people talk about Jordan when he was actually playing. I never got to see him play in person. There was an opportunity. The Bulls came to Nashville for a preseason game, but they wouldn't let me in because it was sold out, and they wouldn't let me sit on anyone's lap because everybody else in my family had a ticket, but I didn't because I was young enough to sit in someone's lap, and they wouldn't let me do it, so I didn't get to go.
Oh, wow. That's cold.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all right, though.
That's messed up, man.
I'll mention Vanderbilt in my Hall of Fame induction speech.
Make sure to.
Yeah. All right. So let's get into the meat of it. What are some things that you want to discuss about the documentary? What was said? What was done?
I am huge on episode 2 because anybody that's willing to listen to me talk about basketball, willing to listen to me talk about greatest players of all time, what makes them great, what differentiates between, you know, who's at the top of my list, who's not at the top of my list, what those small differences are and were, knows that I am incredibly high on Scottie Pippen, his value to the Bulls during his tenure while he was there, and how big of a role he played that I think is undervalued, even knowing current day how essential he was to that Bulls team. And I don't think it really made a lot of sense until, you know, that second episode put all those statistics together where he was leading the team in most stats outside of scoring, but was still just the 6th play player on the team, 122nd highest played player in the league, and just there's a difference when I, as somebody who just watched and appreciate the game, and somebody who has a favorite player that's not named Michael Jordan and have an opinion that the best player in the world of all time is not somebody named Michael Jordan, you know, it's almost blasphemous the moment I start bringing up Scottie Pippen and talking about how important he was to that dynasty, that organization, and honestly, in a sense, the development of Michael Jordan. And of course, the same goes vice versa. But a lot of people don't want to hear that. They, you know, because all you hear about is Mike Jordan. Pippen didn't even have his own shoes. Well, he had his own Nikes, you know, for a little bit, but it wasn't Jordan's, you know. And he doesn't even deserve to be in the top 50 of all time. So to, like, see and hear so many accolades and so much praise for Scottie Pippen just kind of helped give a little justice to my unpopular standpoint in terms of where he stands in terms of not the greatest of all time, but the all-time greats.
Right. Okay. So I guess this is going to be me just taking devil's advocate stances about this documentary because number one, Scotty was severely underpaid, but he also fumbled his bag and didn't negotiate.
He did.
For more. No, he could after the third.
I'm agreeing with you. He did. Oh, okay. He said it himself that, you know, he made the decision early on to secure the definite bag versus gamble on the what ifs of the future.
Yeah, and that's all well and good. So, but that has to also be taken into account. Like, again, that's another angle for Krause to be like, oh man, why didn't you pay that man? He signed a contract.
Yes, he did. But devil's advocate, the devil's advocate, you have just as much ability as a general manager and owner when a player essentially outplays his contract. Now, this one is going to be in a gray area because we don't know how true this one may or may not have been. But assuming that, you know, the first half of his contract, you know, he went through it just fine. You know, I'm going to go ahead and make my $2 million a year. But, hey, now, you know, 3-4 years later that I've outperformed this contract in every way possible and imaginable beyond what either of our imaginations were, can we restructure this contract, make it a little bit more beneficial for me because I've been beneficial for you, and part of our winning ways have been the fact that my meager contract has allowed you to put the pieces around us? No. All right, cool. Thank you. I came to you, tried to have this adult conversation about, you know, making things work after I did what I could to make things work. Now I'm going to go somebody that wants to pay me for my what they think my efforts are worth. So I can see both sides of it, and, you know, Scotty, you signed the contract in the first place. You have a lot of responsibility in this, but front office, you have the ability to restructure a contract to make it more beneficial to a player when they've been a huge part of your success, if not the second biggest part of your success.
Also true. Now, also, what was not mentioned in the documentary that I went ahead and did a little bit of research on.
Tea time.
Was, yeah. In, let's say, in 1995, do you know how much Scottie Pippen made?
1995?
Yeah.
In terms
just
of
make a guess.
His NBA salary?
Yeah, just make a guess at his NBA salary.
1995. That's his second contract. I'm gonna say it was $2 million a year base. So I'm gonna guess after signing both bonus incentives, I'm gonna guess he made about somewhere between 7 to 9 million.
No, sir.
What'd he get?
2.925.
Oh, God. I was trying to be hopeful.
Yeah. Now, do you know how much Michael Jordan made in 1995? Off of his NBA salary?
What did he make?
3.85, Kenny. So, that being said, the gap was very, very small in 1995.
Wait, what year was that? 1995? like 94, 90, that was 95, 96.
Now let's talk about 96, 97. That was the first year Michael Jordan made $30 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm trying to say is that Scotty was only really underpaid because of the ballooned increase Michael Jordan got. Now, to be fair, in 96, 97, Dennis Rodman made $9
million. I was going to say, now, what about what I'm very, very curious here about, I guess, the 3 years prior. So the year he was out playing baseball, the shortened year, and the year before he left. I would love to know what he was making.
He was making three or less, or four or less. 3.85 was his highest earning in 94. And then in 95, that was in 95. And then in 96, he signed his $30 million deal per year. So that's another little tidbit that they didn't put into the documentary that kind of puts in perspective what Scotty was paying. Now, he was still underpaid because he wasn't the second highest earner on the team ever. But when you have Michael Jordan, the engine of your team, making 3.8, and then you have Scottie Pippen making 2.225, that's fairly fair, wouldn't you say?
Yes, but, and here's my only caveat on it, there's no way for us to know, I guess, what possible underwritings there might have been, amplified performance bonuses. There might have been, and this one in and of itself isn't, you know, in any way, shape, or form really, I guess, relatable to it. But, of course, Jordan is getting all the Nike money during those years from Jordan sales. Mm-hmm. But even with all that, there's, you know, the large standpoint of, in comparison, you know, like, who's to say how much space there is between those top salaries at the time and the bottom salaries at the time?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, it was still within a respectable range until 1996 when Jordan signed his $30 million deal. And in 97, when Jordan was making 33, do you know what the cap was?
Nope.
The cap was 27. There was no luxury tax in 1997 for the NBA. So in essence, this is where I make my turn and defend Scottie Pippen. This is where they could have came off of a bag for Scottie and was like, hey, you know what? We got five championships. Here's a piece. And they didn't, because they were tired of paying so much in salary. Their total team salary was $63 million in 1997 versus a $27 million cap. Now, there was no luxury tax, but still, there was no incentive for them to keep running this back and paying more than double what the cap was.
Which isn't unreasonable.
Yeah. So that and I'm surprised that they didn't even ask Reinsdorf about that, about having to pay so much money in salaries. I mean, Phil Jackson was making $6 million as well. Combined with the assistant coaches, now you're reaching, like, just your players and coaches, you're creeping near like $50, $70 million in that general range of just salary. Now, what can you put a price tag on an NBA championship? I don't think so. But Reinsdorf probably wanted to go ahead and start, you know, buckling down financially because what was the cap in 1998? We'll say it was close to 30. You know what their team salary was in 1998?
98, the final year. You said 97, it was 60-some-odd mil, so 98.
No, this was after... This was after the Last Dance.
Oh, post Last Dance? So you're talking 98, 99?
Yeah.
Their cap had to drop to about, what, probably 8, 9 mil? Because Jordan was gone, Pippen was gone, Rodman was gone.
Yeah, well, so the salary cap was 30 million. Team salary was 29 million. So they went from doubling the cap to getting under the cap in a year. That's the reason why they didn't pay Scotty. They just didn't want to be over the cap anymore. But the documentary is dramatizing it to a point where you're thinking it's you know, feelings are being hurt and like there's animosity, but I think this is mostly about money.
Usually in a situation like that is both. Because a big part of it is also that...
Both are in play.
You have taken into consideration players. I don't believe that players were as aware and involved then as they are now in terms of where the league is financially and being involved in understanding and knowing where the league is going financially.
Yeah, that's true. Now, okay, so let's argue: do you think they were right to slash these salaries and pack it up and rebuild, or do you think they should have kept it running?
Honestly,
please,
I'm gonna keep it running. Like I get that there are financial reasons to cut ties, start the rebuild, try to get back in the black and out of the red, but that means you have to believe that they were actually in the red, which I don't think that you can earnestly be in the red as when you are in the midst of not just creating a championship team, but a legitimate dynasty. You know, like once you get to the point of creating a legitimate dynasty, mm-hmm. that's where you can put yourself in the greatest organizations of all time conversation. Of course, you know, there's only two that are actually willing to have that conversation, but that's the point where you can put your organization in a place where you can say, hey, you know, we don't get to actually speak, but now we get to speak at sit at the table for now. You know, we can eat with the grown-ups now, and when our appetite gets bigger, maybe even try to say we got a stake at it. But you don't get that opportunity in rebuild. Plus, being in the midst of that dynasty creates financial opportunities for the team, the city, shoot, the entire state sometimes, depending on, you know, what particular team it is and if it's the only team in the area. And so, no, my thing is always, if you have the opportunity to compete for a championship, do it, because I think being a sports organization that's competing for a championship is more lucrative, even if you're over on your player payroll, than not being a competitor. You know?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that they were definitely getting 75 to 100% of that money back in ticket sales and merchandise and just financial fluidity being the greatest team that many people had ever seen. So I also say run it back. Also, don't multiply Michael Jordan's salary by 10 times. That was a weird choice. I don't think he would have ever walked away if you would have said, "Hey, Mike, you know, I see you're 30, but how about 18, and then we give 10 to Scotty."
I was like, that's all I'm saying. Like, is that really so hard to do? But I think there were just way too many egos, way too many, "I'm the reason that we're here in the first place" attitudes, and just, you know, what comes way too often for some of the greatest teams that we ever see, which is, once you've accrued that much talent, particularly that much talent between so few players, it's impossible to keep it together. In all earnest, the fact that the Bulls were able to do it is only truly accounted to the fact that salaries were so small at the time.
Right. But also, it was a very small cap as well. So I think it was still pretty balanced. And I think they did use a good amount of their money wisely, but not paying Scotty over. I won't even say overpaying Michael Jordan, just giving Michael Jordan that much money when you could have, you know, spread it around a little bit more. If you're going to go over cap anyway, I think that would have soothed tensions, and then you could have ran it all the way to 2000.
Yeah. Or at the very least, run it until, like Jordan said, run it until they lose. And even if they lose, if they don't lose badly, retool and run it back again, bro. Like, you make more money being in the playoffs and in the NBA championship than you do being at home during the summer in the NBA.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Any final thoughts about these first two episodes?
Very intriguing. I like that while there is plenty of Michael Jordan gushing, because of course it's a Bulls documentary, but it's like, let's be real here, it's a Michael Jordan documentary. But mm-hmm. I like that the people that they have speaking, giving their perspectives on what happened, are people who aren't necessarily afraid to say that they may not have agreed with Jordan at that particular time, or Pippen, or Phil. Like, there are enough perspectives that aren't the same to where we're getting a lot of truth and insight in this, even with it still being, like you said, very, very biased, because it is a Pro Bulls, Pro Jordan documentary. So a lot of it is going to be that way. And it's going to present it with what you call being the bad guy. But I think there's a lot of truth in it. There's also mm-hmm. one question that I need answered when this documentary is finished. I need to know, and I'm pretty sure I already know because I'm speculating in the first place. But in Space Jam, the alien boss, short, bald, fat guy, thinks he knows what he's doing, but he doesn't actually know anything about basketball. He just got some guys that are really good, and the aliens that got juiced up powers, and now he thinks he can run stuff. Is that supposed to be Jerry?
Probably.
I think it is, and I think that is, it's hilarious. That's real messed up in retrospect.
Yeah, it's like I said, Michael Jordan is a petty king.
Yes.
But that, yeah, I don't think they'll talk about Space Jam.
No, because that was 96, right? No? Yeah?
Yeah, that was before the fifth year.
Yeah, so. It wasn't at that time anyway. It might pop, it might pop in there because they do a little bit of going back to set the precedent for whatever they're about to talk about. But I don't think we'll get any talk on it exclusively, or not too much anyway. So yeah, now I'm interested to see more what other connections that I didn't know about or wasn't aware about that I can make. And that also makes me wonder if Cavs owner is going to get a cameo in some villainous form in a LeBron Space Jam 2 sequel or Space Jam sequel.
I doubt it. LeBron's a different kind of petty. But yeah, I'm definitely excited to see these other episodes. I'm going to be tuned in every Sunday night for the foreseeable future for the next,
4 weeks.
Yeah. So that's going to be great. I definitely have more questions about, are they going to talk more about the overall financial standpoint of the Bulls and salary caps and how much Michael Jordan was getting paid influenced the decision to make this the Last Dance? That's what I want to know. Will they touch on that, or will they just paint over it and just say, "Oh yeah, I was Michael Jordan. I was ready. I was ready, you know, to do whatever it took, but they weren't, so we had to pack it up."
Except take that pay cut.
Exactly. All right, we're gonna get out of here, Kenny. Any final words?
No. Continue to stay at home. Well, I guess that's not true. Continue to stay at home, guys. Keep coughing in the elbows. Maintain 6 feet. If you can turn around and punch somebody in the face, they are well within your 6 foot zone. So remind them. Subscribe, listen, follow on all social media accounts at In My Bag Pod. That's about all I got.
Very well put. Yeah. We'll see you guys next time. Take care.
And more tune for your head top, so watch how you speak on my name, you know?